Folks, have you checked out the Irish History Podcast shop recently? Right now, I have a sale of 30% off everything when you use the code SALE30. So go to irishhistorypodcast.ie/shop and get 30% off everything when you use the discount code SALE30.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to the Irish History Podcast. My name is Finn Dwyer and this is The Lingon, Exploring Ireland's Oldest Frontier, Part 2. Now last week I began this two-parter of exploring one of the most ancient frontiers in Ireland, the Lingon Valley. This episode continues that story and brings you further down the valley into more recent history. The first stop in this episode is at a place called Kilcash, which is only a mere 800 years old, which is pretty recent compared to what we talked about last week. And then the show finishes at a 1798 battlefield. In these episodes recorded in the Lingon Valley, I'm joined by Neil Jackman, who's an expert on the area. Now, if you want to find out more about the Lingon Valley, I would strongly recommend checking out tua.ie. This is a service Neil operates that has online lectures and itineraries so you can find your way around historic and archaeological landscapes like the Lingon and other amazing places across Ireland. That website is tua.ie. Now today's episode starts at a place called Kilcash, a pretty famous medieval church and castle. In our conversation though, Neil touches on lots of topics, everything from how medieval Ireland was more influenced by international trends than you might imagine, right down to how gunpowder made castles obsolete. So we've arrived at Kilcash, church and castle. This is further south down the valley, really, is it?
Yeah, we're actually just on... I wouldn't know if we're technically even on the Lingon Valley as such now. We're just on the hinterland, just okay. At the very edge of it. But I thought it was an interesting place to come and look at because you kind of got two big stories here about slightly later periods in than we've experienced so far. We're here at the moment at the church of Kilcash. And it's quite an interesting little one. And again, it's one of those places which is very much overlooked, not really visited. A lot of people would pass this by on the road and they might see the castle from the road, but few would know that there's this little lovely Romanesque church here. Now, the Romanesque period, you know, as we were talking about briefly there before, you're looking around about the 12th century. A lot of change actually happens in island society in the 12th century. So it moves from, into a kind of diocesan system, the church, the Irish church. It becomes more regulated and in line with the rest of Europe. So you end up with kind of bishoprics and things like that. And you get the diocese then of Ossory becomes the diocese and all of this kind of thing. So Ireland's way of practicing Christianity in a way is becoming more in line with the broader church, and that's why we call this kind of architecture Romanesque as well, because it's reflecting what you would see on the continent more than what had been here before.
Well, the organization of the church is changing, its physical appearance, if you're going to mass at the time, you can see that change play out very small communities, or very, small is the wrong word, but in very local communities, I suppose is what I'm saying.
Absolutely, and along with that as well, so we're talking here kind of, that happens, Synod of Rathbrasil, I believe, in about 1111, right? And churches like this, you start to see them more commonly by the middle of the 12th century, by 1150, 1160, 1170. But at that time as well, you start to get the continental monastic orders coming into Ireland as well, particularly the Cistercians. So not only is the practice of belief and religion and Christianity changing, but the Cistercians bring in new farming techniques. They bring in new ways of working the land. So even the landscape begins to change at this time as well.
This has all happened, though, in advance of the Norman invasion, which obviously begins in around the year 1170.
Yes.
But there is these changes happening that, to a degree, facilitate the much broader changes that take place in the aftermath of the Norman invasion, obviously, when land wholesale passes from the Gaelic Irish into the hands of the Normans.
Yes.
But some of that change, highlighted in actually a building like this, is already just being eased in, I suppose, for want of a better term.
Exactly. People are looking outwards, and they're looking at outwards in a way that they necessarily didn't take on as much before. You always had movement, right? Even in the early forms of Christianity, even in the Neolithic that we saw earlier, you know, you'd see similar types of passage through Martin, Brittany and the Iberian Peninsula, as you would here in Ireland. So movements had always happened, and particularly in Christianity, Irish monks went to the continent and to Britain, and vice versa, they came here too. But now you start to see a more kind of hierarchical, more kind of organizational change. And much like we saw with the High Crosses in being an expression of sort of the power or the tastes, if you like, of the patron, you start to see that with these Romanesque churches as well. This is, I'm not some backward little king only looking at my own place. I'm looking outwards, and I'm acting like a French king would.
Okay.
I'm acting like, you know, somebody like that. So, I had an interesting discussion there with Tiger Keith as well, that you might see Motton Baileys, and there are actually quite a few around the Lingon Valley. There's these great earthen mounds where a wooden castle would be placed on top. And there was a defensive enclosure around them called a bailey. And that's typically seen as a very Norman invention. That's part of their expansion and conquest, if you like, of these parts of Ireland. But some of those motts actually might be pre-Norman. These are the first version of the Irish castles, if you like. And one of the first places, or the most notable places you might see that, is the Furrah on the Hill of Tara.
Okay.
You know, that might be one. There might be another one at, you know, there's a couple of candidates. There's another one maybe in Kilfinan and Limerick and things like that too. So people like Brian Boru, for example, who died in 1014 at Clontarf, he was already looking to Europe for ideas. That only accelerates when we get into the 12th century. And a church like this is a real expression of that. And the main way that you would know a Romanesque church when you come into one is always the very ornate, fabulous doorways that they have,
which we just walked
through. This one here is a little bit weathered.
Yeah.
It's made out of sandstone. But when you go to some of the better preserved ones, say like the Nuns' Church at Clonmacnoise or Dyser Tordee down in County Clare, you can see they're covered in like human heads, animal heads, chevrons and zigzags. They're the most flamboyant pieces of stone architecture, I think, on the island, in a sense. They really are incredible. And it's interesting to see that expression of art, European identity and all of that right here in the quiet little Lingon Valley.
This church is probably a lot smaller, though, than people at home might think.
Yeah.
The building itself, I'm trying to compare it to something that people might be able to imagine, but it's...
It'd be like a very big cottage.
Yeah,
it wouldn't be too much out of the way of kind
like you're
of
not going
a,
to have more than,
cottage.
I don't know, you're going to have less than 100 people in here in terms of even if everyone is standing kind of thing.
Quite possibly. Not everyone was probably allowed inside in a sense as well. You're probably looking at a kind of a higher rank of society and such, and of course the clergy and the whatever, you know, people are serving that here as well. It's separated by a large wall into two. So you've got the chancel end, which is where, you know, the priests and someone would be performing the mass, and the nave end, which is where the common people would be, or the local populace would be. But this looks, when you look at it, doesn't it look like it's been inserted in a later time? You can see it's not quite flush with the original structure and things like that.
Yes.
So it's always interesting, I think, coming looking at a building like this, because in one sense, when you first see it, you might think it's telling one story of one period. But you look closely and you start to see where windows have been blocked up and doors have been changed. And what you're seeing then is an expression of continuity and change and reapplication over a very long period of time.
Similar enough to what we were talking about at the very start back at Rinnock Row.
Yeah, exactly.
And do we know when this building would have been, do we have a date for this? Or is it?
You'd be probably looking in the second half of the 12th century. So I'd say somewhere from about 1150 to probably about 1180, give or take, something around that sort of way. So a few hundred years on from a last site in a Henny. What's really nice as well is you got some really interesting headstones here the 17th and 18th and 19th centuries. Yeah. Looking at this one here, this is from, can we see the date?
52
or 32. But it's got the depiction of the crucifixion, but it's got all the symbols of the passion there as well. So you can see the scourge where Jesus was whipped with. You can see the lance that he used. Normally they display the dice. Yeah, there's the dice that they threw for Jesus' clothes and all of this. And it's a really kind of charming little bit of kind of folk art in a way. Yeah. So again, when you're looking at these historic churchyards and graveyards, have a look for these smaller features too that can sometimes be easily overlooked. I think it's quite interesting.
Speaking of graves, there is one particular grave down here that you mentioned in the car on the way over.
Yeah.
Who is this? And I suppose that leads us on to the castle that's not too far from here as well.
Well, it does. It's the Butler Mausoleum, actually. So the Butlers were an incredibly powerful family in Kilkenny and most famously associated, of course, with Kilkenny Castle.
Yeah.
So they owned all of this as well. They're a huge powerhouse.
This is after the Norman conquest, I should say, to people at home.
So the first butler comes in just after the conquest. He comes in with, I think he comes over with
John,
John or Henry, He comes in a little bit later when the hard work's done. And he rises to power, essentially. They get the name Butler because he was the chief cupbearer, the ceremonial cupbearer to the king, you know, which was a very prestigious position at the time. So the mausoleum is here. Now, most of the medieval butlers you would find buried either in St. Canice's Cathedral in Kilkenny or in Gowran in St. Mary's.
There's a lovely tomb, actually, there of one of the early butlers, actually, from the 14th century.
It's been a while since I've been in here now. Actually, this is a blocked up church. But yes, the mausoleum, essentially, what it is, it's you got a few generations of the butlers in there, including Margaret Butler, who died in 1744. And she's the one who, you know, there's that very famous lament. I say, unfortunately, I can't do the Irish version of it, but the first couple of lines, "Now what will we do for timber with the last of the wood laid low?" You know, which is, people take as kind of an expression of not only the kind of the loss of the generations of the butlers in a particularly pivotal time in Irish history in the 18th century, but also with the last of the woodlands essentially being cleared out at that time. The last of Ireland's great oaks and things like that were being harvested for the Royal Navy, essentially, to be turned into ships and building materials, you know. So she's in there along with Colonel Thomas Butler. And, you know, when we go along to the castle, we'll kind of talk a little bit more about them and how their fortunes kind of rose and fell, so to speak, in this area.
But will we head up? So we've come about 200 metres up from the church. And now we're looking at a tower house, which with one of the great features of Irish historical sites, a danger keep out sign. But Neil, do you want to tell us what we're looking at here? It's a pretty spectacular tower house in terms of it's a lot bigger than many you'd see. And then it has what I assume was a modern addition at some point built onto it. But yeah, do you want to tell us what we're looking at here?
Yeah, again, this is an expression in a way of us being on a borderland, a frontier land here, because as you drive around this bit along kind of Waterford, Tipperary, Kilkenny, you see so many tower houses in the landscape. This is one of dozens within a fairly short stretch of countryside. I believe it's an island, the most castellated country per square mile or something like that. It's certainly up there anyway in Europe. So this was built originally by the Wall family in the 15th century. but it passed to the butlers by the middle of the 16th century, by about 1540.
I might just get you to explain exactly physically what's in front of us for listeners.
So essentially, a tower house, it's like the name kind of expresses, it's essentially a castle in just a tower form. So rather than it having big battlements going all the way around and all the rest of it and curtain walls, it's focused very much into, I think that's probably about 5 stories high. It has what you call reticulations at the corners, so people could, you know, defensive features at the corners and the upper floors and things like that. At the bottom of it, you would enter, and the great hall would be, I think, generally on the first or the second floor, and then there's accommodation for the family in the one above. So it's, they're not uncommon in Ireland. This, as you say, is a particularly large one, though. And they were the homes, really, of the wealthy Irish elite. And by this stage, the butlers were Irish as such, you know, yeah. By the 16th century that we're talking about here, and the walls as well. So this would have been kind of, it would have been surrounded a sort of a smaller version of a curtain wall, in a sense, that would have been kind of protecting the outer bats. But when we look at this one now, we can see there's a shell, essentially just one wall left of another structure that was added probably in the 17th century by the looks of that, or maybe even the early 18th century. Somebody told me, I don't know how accurate this is, but somebody told me this was used when the butlers had it as something of a pleasure house. So if they were looking to, the young butler men were looking to take courtesans away for a bit of hunting and a bit of a laugh and so on, this would be discreetly away from Kilkenny and the prying eyes of the family, that they could come up here for a bit of a party. Yeah, for sure. By the 17th century, it had largely gone. By the 18th century, it was fairly in ruins. And it was sold to the state for £500 in relatively recently. Relatively recently. I'll have to check my notes on that one. And over the last kind of 20 years, I think, it's been completely covered in scaffolding. There's been, since it's been in the hands of the OPW in the state, they've been doing a huge job trying to conserve the building. They now look to be on the last stages of that now. Unfortunately, it's still locked and it's still kind of inaccessible for us today. But, it's...
Is the plan, to open it to the public, or...?
I would hope so. I mean, it looks in pretty good fettle now. I don't know what it's like on the inside, but the outside certainly looks in good condition, yeah. So it was really after 1758, so it was really middle 18th century that this place started to fall into kind of disrepair.
I suppose that coincides, and maybe we can talk more about it at the final site we're going to go to, but in the emergence, I suppose, of what we call modern history, late 18th, 19th century, you've got lots of changes in terms of the administration of Ireland, but also in terms of building and techniques and things like that.
Yeah.
And tower houses, whilst they might be good in terms of defensive structures, they're not very homely. No. They're, I would imagine, very hard to heat. They tend to have spiral staircases, which are not easy to traverse, particularly for people who might be elderly or injured or whatever. Yeah. So you can easily see why the butlers, if they have the resources to do it, are going to start moving to more quote-unquote modern houses. Now, what I mean is a house that would be 200-300 years old today, but maybe starting to represent or to be reminiscent of a contemporary housing, and that would have, maybe 2-3 floors.
That's right.
Staircases that are straight, things like that.
Well, that's it. I mean, essentially, the good points of a tower house, its defensiveness, is essentially became obsolete by that stage as well, because of the improvement in cannon and things like that.
Something like this can be demolished quite easily if needed.
Exactly, and many were, especially in the 17th century during the Confederacy Wars and during kind of Cromwell's time. So the good aspects of it, the positives, then quickly fell away, and the negatives, as you say, the practicalities, trying to go up a spiral staircase if you're pregnant, trying to, navigate it if you're, elderly or infirm. And you can see the change towards that now. When we look at that building to the side with its big windows, again, that's, as we've been talking all the time, there's change, there's continuity, but there's change too. And this is more looking like a kind of late Tudor kind of coming into the, 1600s, 1700s kind of manor. And actually a really good place to see that, where it's all intact, is, say, Donegal Castle, big tower house on one side, and you have the ruins then of like a late kind of Tudor sort of mansion attached to the side of it, because defence goes out of the window.
Yeah, because looking at what's remained, it's only really one wall, but what's remained, it obviously had no defence capabilities at all. There's three huge windows on the ground floor, and then three huge windows on the first floor.
Yeah,
it's clearly not being designed. But increasingly by that point, I suppose, Ireland had been subdued. Like the Norman invasion, I think it's fair to say, was never a complete invasion. It had at its maximum reached maybe 75% of the island and then went into retreat. But certainly after the Cromwellian conquest, you're talking about mopping up operations maybe into the... Yeah. And then obviously by the end of the 17th century, the defeat or the victory of William of Orange, I think, really copper fastens a new period of Irish history. Yeah. But I suppose these frontiers that we've talked about that really had considerable differences start to melt away or lack the importance that they would once have had, like crossing the distance we have in this podcast by, I don't know, 1750, for example. You're not moving, you're moving within the same country, within the same legal system, really. Whereas in previous times, you would have actually noticed, like you talked earlier, considerable differences over short periods of time. And maybe at the last site, which is 1798 Battlefield, that might be an opportunity to talk about, I suppose, the emergence of modern Ireland.
From Kilcash, we went to our final stop along the Lingon Valley, a place called Carrigmacleer, the site of a battle in 1798. While this has a fascinating story attached to it, it also helps understand why the Lingon Valley is not really that significant in modern Ireland.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ireland.
People might be able to hear at home, Neil, I'm out of breath. We've walked up quite a steep hill. We're at Carrigmacleer, and this is a 1798 battle site. And I think that's going to be a nice conclusion to the journey we've taken along what was an ancient frontier. Yeah. Can you explain a little bit about what happened here? It's just to let people know there's absolutely stunning views. If you are in the area and you kind of follow our footsteps, definitely come up here for the views alone. There's a stunning view of the Golden Vale. But sorry, Neil, take it away and let me catch my breath over here.
It is a beautiful location. It is a very steep hillside. It really is. It's a bit of a walk after the nice lowlands down below. And you know, you got a big Marian Cross up here as well that was put in, I think, in the 1950s or 60s. But like, it is this very prominent location, and it's because of that that the engagement was here. You see, this is the site of the only, as far as I'm aware, and you know, I'm no expert on this period, but I think it's the only military engagement in County Tipperary in 1798. And what was supposed to happen is that there's supposed to be a big beacon fire lit on top of this hill, which was then the signal for the whole rebellion to kick off across this part of Tipperary.
You can imagine if there is a fire up here, it would be visible for
miles and miles around. You've got such an elevated position. So this big beacon was supposed to kind of raise everybody to arms and send everyone out. But unfortunately, the rebels were betrayed by a local innkeeper, and he lived in a 9 mile house, and somebody talked too much in the pub, as will happen. He informed a guy called William Despard of Killahy Castle, and he was the head of the local yeomanry. So he lit a fire on the hill to create a false signal before the real beacon was supposed to be lit, and that lured everybody out into a trap. He was ready and waiting for them. He made contact beforehand with the British forces in Kilkenny, and they surrounded the hill, essentially. A good number, I think several were killed actually in the engagement here. Many more were arrested and then later taken away for execution. So they were betrayed for basically talking too loose in the pub, I think, unfortunately, and it was a pretty cunning trap that was stirred for them. And that became then the, I suppose, the kind of pivotal moment in 1798. And when you look at the broader story of 1798, there became something that had such potential to change the country in a way, but each one of these individual actions, whether it was in Kildare, Wexford, here, you know, or Mayo, they kind of started with a bit of promise, but they were just the amount of informers, the amount of kind of traps that were set, that bit of kind of experience in some ways from the kind of the British forces in some of these areas. It just snuffed each of these key threats out, that they could never do a big coordinated uprising across the country all at once. Makes you think, if this would have succeeded here, you know, if Kildare hadn't, you know, Fitzgerald hadn't been captured right at the beginning, what would have happened at that point? You know, because there was a lot going for the uprising in the initial stages, but
it just wasn't. I suppose it is that thing that people kind of often forget, it is the largest uprising in modern Irish history, like far larger than, say, like obviously, say something like the 1916 Rising, or even probably those involved in the War of Independence. Just the amount of people who participated, and certainly the amount of people killed in the aftermath of it, which ran into the tens of thousands, I think.
Yeah.
But I think just we started off this 5,000 years ago up as, we didn't start 5,000 years ago, but...
feels like it after walking up that hill.
But... Yeah. Over the course of that, we've visited various places where that frontier, for one reason or another, remained very important in the landscape. But up here, I guess, in the aftermath, particularly in the 1798 rebellion, but it wasn't because of the 1798 rebellion, but as modern Ireland, and when I say modern Ireland, I'm taking that long view of 200, 250 years, emerges, those traditional boundaries start to... that they no longer have the same meaning or resonance that they would once have had as new political, economic boundaries. I guess even, I suppose, the most important boundary on the island of Ireland today is obviously the border between Northern Ireland and the Republic. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't have a historical precedent. Obviously, in parts, it follows the traditional border of Ulster, but it's very much forged by modern considerations. And I guess what I'm getting at is that this boundary though here that we've followed kind of, I wouldn't say becomes obsolete. We mentioned the hurling connection that runs into the present. But it is an interesting thing about the modern world that I guess the rate of change in the last 200 years is becoming, in the long view, this really decisive moment in the history of this part of the world, in that traditions that continued on for thousands of years, transcended the arrival of Christianity, are now losing that importance.
Absolutely. I mean, in a sense, all history is local. You know, even if it's a big, momentous event, it still happened with the particular community around it. And borders and barriers like that, I think, are dependent on those communities to maintain them, in a sense. And when it no longer makes sense for those communities to do so, they go away fairly quickly. And in the case here, where we're looking at the Lingon Valley, you've definitely got this cultural boundary that has existed for, you know, certainly 5,000 years. And the fact that it's essentially just a county boundary now, and we look at a country like Ireland, and which was never, I think it'd be fair to say, never a united country in its sense, apart from, unless you want to call it under British Empire, I suppose, then it was under one edge, if you like, but it was never, it was always a place of boundaries and borders. And I think any time you find one of these borderlands, take a look around you in the landscape, because there's lots and lots of stories written on there because of that border. You know, we've seen everything from cultural boundaries, with the high crosses and the passage tombs, to, you know, military boundaries when we're looking at things like the, you know, Kilcash Castle and now up here with 1798 and, you know, the beacon that would have been lit up here as well. So I think wherever you find these border territories, they're interesting places, and they continue to be interesting places even when the particular border disappears.
Yeah, for sure, because you can even see it in other parts of the country, like in Westmeath, say, the old boundaries between the Old Kingdom of Meath and Leinster and Connacht, you get that similar material culture because of that friction point in the landscape that you do get, like, plenty to explore, as you say. But I'm going to put in the show notes of this where we've been today. It's definitely worth people coming and follow, checking out these places, because each one has so much to see. You know, even, as I said, the views from up here are stunning.
Well, yeah, and we, you know, I love this place. I mean, it's only up the road from me in Clonmel, and, you know, we've got this concentration of monuments. We've only scratched the surface. You know, there's many more high crosses and prehistoric tombs and lots of standing stones and stuff like that as well, but we'd be at it constantly, you know.
For 5,000 years.
But what I tried to do with the kind of the new venture we got to it is to help people find these places. So we made an itinerary map, actually, which has the coordinates and instructions on how to find these things and the significance of them, of some of the best of the sites as well. And I'll happily give you a link that if you want.
Great,
to
I'll put that in the show notes. And do you have any podcasts from that would relate to any of the sites we've covered today, or even the general areas that, you know, that people could maybe listen to as they're coming along?
Well, we've got lots of articles as well. So for sites like Henny and Knockrow and things like that, so people can read a little bit more about the history of these places and the significance of what was found archaeologically. In terms of podcasts, I have two in particular that kind of jump out as recommendations. I did a really interesting one just before the last winter solstice with Marissa Sullivan, talking about the Lingon Valley in general, but more specifically about Knockrow and his excavations there. And we talk about the significance of this landscape, how interesting it is. So I think that's a really good discussion. And because this area is so, I suppose, resplendent with high crosses, the one with Roger Stalley talking about, you know, because I always bring up the Ossory crosses whenever I'm talking to somebody who knows the stuff about them, because I'm so interested in that question about, are they particularly old, or are they just a different cultural expression? Because they do look so different to the rest of the high crosses on the island. So those two in particular, I think people would hopefully get a little kick out.
I think it is definitely worth, though, probably listening to that, reading the articles, because you do get so much more out of places like this. Because sometimes what you're trying to appreciate is the landscape. It's not necessarily something immediately in front of you.
No.
It's that broader. And hopefully a bit of what we've talked about today will convey that to you at home. If you are, and even if you're overseas on tour, you'll be able to, on Neil's website, you'll be able to, and I'll have links to that in the show notes as well, you'll be able to see an awful lot of what we're talking about.
Absolutely.
I'm going to leave it there. Neil, thanks very much for joining me today. And no doubt people will catch up with you on Amplify Archaeology, and hopefully you'll be back on the show again before too long.
Absolutely, Finn. It's always a pleasure going wandering around a few old monuments on a nice sunny day like today.
That's lovely, isn't it?
Yeah, it's beautiful. Thanks, Finn.
I'd like to thank Neil for his time. You can check out links to his podcast and that service he operates, Tua.ie, in the show notes below. Sound on today's episode was by Kate Dunley. Until next time, Sloan.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.